Welcome to episode 3284 of the Survival Podcast. We are going to be continuing our series on biochar today. As many of you know, I really started getting into biochar right about the first of the year and have become sort of obsessed and consumed with it. Some of the earlier episodes we did this year got somehow exposed to Mark and Lori Mann of American Biochar. And so they're going to be on today to talk about biochar, and we can kind of continue this journey together learning more about it, because I think it is one of the things that truly unlocks a tremendous potential that's being underutilized in America today, which is our ability to grow our own food and support ourselves and our local communities. We'll get into that deep in just a moment. Before we do, let me remind you, while you're on today, if you're on the live feed and you're asking a question or giving us a talking point, please put the first few letters in all caps, just like John did here. If you do that, I'll be likely to see it out of my one good eye, and I'll star it, and we will handle it at the end during the Q&A section. Also, remember, just my kind of go-to PSA here, I will never contact you for any private information in the video comments or anywhere else in social media or anything like that. The best way to get in touch with me, always email Jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. I promise you, if you email that address, you'll be talking to me and no one else, because people have been scammed out of all kinds of things online with people doing impersonations, and I have more than a few of them myself. Anyway, with that, before we dig deep into it, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor today, number one today, is ButcherBox. I've been a ButcherBox customer, and they've been a sponsor at the same time now for, about 5 years. And I just really love ButcherBox. I love having these giant boxes of meat shipped right to my door every month. They do a discount for my members in the MSB. That'll be $10 off every box every month for as long as you keep your subscription. That's $120 a year on my $50 membership. So they're a great supporter at that. The quality of the food's excellent. How good is it? It's so good that they don't pay me in money. Nope, they pay me in a box of meat. Every month, in return for my sponsorship, I get an allowance toward my box of meat, and they send me meat. Barter is better sometimes. And when it's pastured poultry, pastured pork, and grass-fed beef, it's even better. So check them out today at butcherbox.com. And remember, even if you're not an MSB member, it would be good to go through my banner, not because I get a referral, because I don't, because they're a sponsor, but because you'll get at least a discount on your first box just because you are a member of our audience. Next up today is the Ridge Wallet Company at ridge.com. This is another one of those sponsors, been around for quite a while now, about 5 years. They reached out to me and they asked if they could send me some stuff. And I was like, sure, but I don't know if it's really a good fit for my audience. I started carrying the Ridge Wallet. I still carry the same one they sent me. I just got one of the Apple AirTag adapters for it. I haven't installed it yet, so I can't lose the dadgone thing. But I tend not to lose it because it's easy to carry. It's not like a billfold where you're sitting on it. They also have a really great lineup now of EDC gear. They've gone from being kind of a company that sold a wallet and a phone case to a company selling a full line of everyday carry stuff. Really cool. So check them out today at ridge.com. And with that, I want to welcome our special guests to the Survival Podcast. Mark and Lori Mann of American Biochar. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hello.
Good All right, so since y'all are a couple, I don't get in the way of that. If I throw stuff at you, you guys decide who speaks first, because I will not mediate a married couple. I know better.
Smart man.
If we have them in a class where it's an active do thing, we actually separate husbands and wives and put them on separate sides of the room. but anyway, I wanted to kind of start out with, before we dig into biochar itself, can you tell us a little bit about y'all's background? Like, again, you guys pick who speaks first, but not post-biochar, pre-biochar. Like, what kind of, like, background do you have? Who are you? How to connect with the audience question? And when you get up to where biochar is involved, stop.
Okay.
All right. Since we have been married for 39 years, almost 40, But I'll let my wife go first because that's appropriate.
Well, actually, Mark and I actually dated in high school. Went our separate ways. He's like, Lori, we didn't want that far back. Then got back together in college. Mark's background is in forestry and agronomy, and my background was in biology and chemistry. I thought I liked biology more than chemistry because that's not easy stuff. And mm-hmm. I ended up really loving chemistry and realizing biology is the culmination of chemistry, of the chemistry of what's happening. Mark was in forestry and has worked in, you know, I almost rather you just tell him
I'll
that.
I'll take care of myself.
But here's a real cool thing, Jack. And we've sat in the evenings and kind of talked and said, isn't this funny? All of our backgrounds, the two of us in some ways are both in a, we just kind of kept moving forward. He and his path and some of this stuff and me and my path and some of our stuff to the point where we got to here. And it just kind of is really kind of crazy how that worked out. But please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's shortchanging herself on all the stuff she's done, but that's okay, I guess. My background is in forest management and in soil science agronomy, pretty university. started the first company, Plant Growth Management Systems, in 1999 after I worked for American Electric Power for 15 years. I was one of the fortunate individual, I guess, that got put in charge of testing a couple different triazoles, which are fungicides that act as a growth regulator. I'm not going to go too deep into that, other than the fact that we were working with trees and controlling their physiological functions, their biology, naturally, which intrigued me. Because we weren't using a chemical to suppress or to kill. We were actually using their own resources, which... Mm-hmm. Which led me to, in 1999, to on a 10-year-old test plot, to start thinking about, you know, we've done such great things with the plants and trees, and we can keep them out of drought stress, and we can reduce insect and disease attack, but I forgot about the soil.
So the even root system.
And that was sometimes you get so focused on what you're doing that you don't really look where you should be looking. So it took me almost 15 years, and at the end of one test plot, and I realized at that time that the soil is the biggest problem right here. So that, and at that time...
You worked with Dr. Cheney at
I did, but I'll talk more about that later because I don't want to delve into that right now.
Okay.
So the soil science and understanding trees and plant physiology, that kind of thing.
Very cool. So... What was, like, your light bulb moment with biochar where you guys were like, this is something we need to understand better and do something with?
Okay. I'll continue on that one. So in 1999, it was September, and it was the end of a 10-year-long test plot. And we had just realized that we had created a massive fine root hairs. And you can actually pull that one picture up, Jack, if you want
comparison of treated and untreated trees. And you can just see, you can tell the difference. It's amazing.
That's there. Yeah. No, keep going.
Mm-hmm. Is that it?
No. Keep going.
It's two different roots.
No. You're okay, getting closer.
I think we passed it. There it is.
Yeah. No, keep going.
I don't know, guys.
You're getting
there. We go.
Okay. First slide.
So that moment right there, that moment.
That's the light bulb.
That was a light bulb moment, and that's my young hand in that picture. I think I was 34 years old or something like that. I'm 61 now, so that tells you it's been a while ago. And right there is when Dr. Cheney, Bill Cheney, Purdue University, took that picture because I invited him up to see the results of this test plot. And that's when I said, Bill, I said, if we just had some kind of a fixed carbon or something that would stay in the soil, we could solve this problem of these tree coffins indefinitely.
Yeah, we call them tree coffins.
So that was in 1999. It took almost 13 plus years to find the first high quality biochar. So it's been a long trek.
And it's because and that is really kind of zeroing. At the time I was teaching chemistry and biology, and he was working as a forester for a utility. And but the point is we started zeroing in when we started that the company, he likes to call it company number one, Plant Growth Management Systems. When we were looking at this, what we were trying to do is really help the urban trees, the urban forest. And so with the Pacbuzol, it would enhance the root growth, but the soil was still so poor. And so that was one of his frustrations. And we started with trees and how we could get these trees, and you use the term tree coffin, and it is. They're put in a small area. Usually they take all the soil out before they put plants in. You know how bad is. They do that in neighborhoods.
Just for the people that couldn't see the picture, first of all, the roots were, I would say, about 4x the root mass, maybe 5x the root mass in the picture. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is what they're really talking about is like when you go to a parking lot and you're looking for that tree you can park under for the shade, they're talking about trees like that. They're like they're basically underneath, they can reach out as much as they want, but they're in basically road base is what's underneath there. And they're captive there, or they're in nature strips or things like that. And I know there's been a lot of work with biochar recently in enhancing soil structure for those. And that's kind of what y'all are talking about.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So we were focusing on, in fact, I developed multiple protocols within company number one, Plant Growth, to pull trees out of severe decline, reduce transplantation shock on newly planted trees. You know, there's all kinds of stuff I did.
Drought stress.
But it all came down to the fact that a charged biochar actually does more than we had done in a decade of testing and using other products. So that was the aha moment. And so it went from our focus on urban trees or, you know, yard trees or whatever, to agriculture, which obviously that's another story in itself. But we thought, well, okay, we have poor soils in our fields too. In fact, some of the worst soils, believe it or not, are in our fields. So can we do the same thing in agriculture that we've done on turf, on trees, on landscape? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of been the path.
Yeah. And if I can jump on that, Jack. Yeah. There we go. Good. Yeah.
For the people on audio, I've got an image up now of a parking lot with trees in it, kind of what we're talking about. This is because I get some questions here. This is what he's talking about. Go ahead, sir.
Well, I was going to just add to this, and sometimes when we're talking with people, we bring up these points. 50 to 70% of the original carbon stock is missing in the soil, in any soils, especially the agriculture. And we want to touch on that later on with what we were talking about today. I've gotten research that says we have 44 years of harvest left if we don't change anything. No, that's scary.
We have less than that.
Yeah, well.
No, I agree.
Yeah. I heard about phosphorus, but we also, here's where it comes back around. Here's that circular thing. The nutrient density in the average supermarket vegetables are approximately 40% lower than 50 years ago.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's that one question that I threw in with you about how does this all relate, but I digress.
No, you're right. And I mean, like I just covered recently just on nitrogen uptake, right? So your primary macronutrient that all plants need, because phosphorus is even worse than what I'm about to give. But in the 1950s, after World War II, and we just started dumping this chemical fertilizer, about 80 to 88% of the amount of nitrogen you dumped on a field ended up in plants. Today it's less than 20.
Yeah.
Right. So that's, and it's the same. If it's anything, it would be quote unquote better fertilizer than they had back then, like advancements in chemistry and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it's, and this is where people struggle with understanding this. You can test a field and there's tons of nitrogen, there's tons of phosphorus, but the plants can't get to it.
Exactly.
And it is biology, but it's also, like you said, chemistry, because when you put the carbon in the soil, then the biology can function. And what we've done is we've denuded and killed these fields. And all you got to do is look at what happens when the spring rains come too heavy and early, and you see everything that happens. Like the whole field washes away.
Well, I don't know if you saw that one thing I shared with you, Jack. It was the microbe job fair.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to pull that one up. That one I thought was kind of funny. And here's the thing. What we have done is we have bypassed the natural cycle that was intended for plants, the most synergistic, the most full spectrum, call it what you want, the most effective way for plants, it doesn't matter which one either, to get the nutrients that they need in the soil is not through the liquid synthetic fertilizers. No. It bypasses the biology. The whole purpose of the biology, okay, side note, move over here. When we eat food, we digest it, but who does most of the work? The biology in mm-hmm. our guts. And so we're basically, sorry, this might be gross, but we're basically, our nutrition is actually the microbe poop. And, you know, and so in our soils with all that biology, the process, the intent was to take all that organic matter and break it through, process, and they break it through, and then they provide the food in the form that the plant needs.
Mm-hmm.
By doing the liquid synthetic, for, you know, maybe it's granular, but the point being, by bypassing the biology, we do two things. First of all, we are not giving, and we have no idea what is missing. We are not providing the full spectrum of nutrients that are necessary for a plant because we're so arrogant, we put all this stuff in and think it's all okay because, you know, it's what we can test and see the most of. We have no idea if there's a linchpin essential nutrient that everything else is needing to actually work. So we bypass the biology. So two things happen. First of all, the plant doesn't get all the nutrients it needs in the form it needs. You just mentioned it. A lot of that fertilizer goes straight through and isn't caught by the plants either. And it might be actually in the soil, but it's a weak plant. And then the biology is starving,
yep.
and or goes dormant or whatever. And then so what that leads to is back to that part about the nutrient density being 40% less than 50 years ago. So I just had to grab onto that one because that's a real big deal for us. And for me in particular, I laugh sometimes telling people it should be American Biology Company, shouldn't it? Because I talk more about biology
yeah.
than I do biochar.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then people wouldn't know what you are.
No.
Right? You're following good marketing by saying what you do and doing what you say, right?
Yeah.
That's how we get people into permaculture. We put out videos of little baby ducks running around. And they're like, oh, look at the cute duck. And then you're like, next thing you're like, let's talk about the hydrology of swales, right? It's a trick. Marketing's always a little bit of a trick. But let's dig into biochar a little bit. Like one of the big things that you always have to contend with is people not understanding kind of what we're talking about. The biochar is a house for the bioorganisms. It's a shelter. I like comparing it to a coral reef system. Is all these critters attach themselves and then all these nutrients are adsorbed and stick. And what that means is putting naked char onto soil is probably not a good idea. And I think there's two reasons for that. One, we don't want people doing it being unhappy. But the second is an awful lot of, especially the earliest research, which seems to me like it was part of a cabal to not let biochar become something, like they didn't want it for whatever reason, was rigged, whether intentionally or due to incompetence, I don't know. But they would take two fields that were the same and they would throw biochar on one and not throw it on the other, and then they would grow plants and say the ones without the biochar did better. Well, duh. Can you kind of talk about the why of that and why it's important to understand what we do with the char before we use it?
Okay, I want to talk about part of that, but I'm going to turn this over to Lori. You are going to do the talking in this one. Trust me, I have plenty to say,
yes.
But and you have a lot to add, so I'm going to put it over to you.
All right.
But biochar, and we use that same terminology. In fact, when you use the coral reef terminology,
yeah,
I was like, yay, because that's exactly how we figured that that's the best way to explain it to people. You know, if we start talking about all the science behind what's happening in the soil, it just goes over the top. So you have to think about what did everybody at some point see on TV or the internet? You know, back in my day, it was TV. Everybody knew what a coral reef was, right? And everybody knows that when our reefs are dying, our oceans are dying. So that's such a good analogy, but you're exactly right. Now, the thing is that and by the way, we proved this when we went to Haiti, which we'll talk about later. I would love to talk about that in detail, but not right now. But if you think there's no biology in the soil, and you think, oh my gosh, I have to add some kind of micro pack and, you know, get my bacteria and fungi in there, you're wrong. They're there. They're dormant. They're waiting. What they need is a base and a food source. Mm-hmm. So their food source is, it could be anything you're doing with it. It could be duck manure. It could be compost tea. It could be humate, whatever. But it has to be charged with something first. So they're there. They're just waiting. It's not like nature says, oh, geez, we screwed up. I guess there's no microbes left. They're there. They're hibernating. They're dormant. So when you're adding that biochar, you're giving that opportunity for that micro population to start expanding and growing. And that's why, Jack, when you said it's probably not a good idea just to add naked char by itself, you're absolutely right. Now, it will self-charge, but it will take a couple of years to do it. So then that's all I'm going to say about that.
Well, no, that's good. And just a side note on that, we are not against adding microbial packets, any kind of bacterial, fungal, mycorrhizae, and all that. By the by, just a side note, we find it a little bit interesting when we have too much push on just mycorrhizae and we don't include bacteria, because actually, naturally speaking, fungi and bacteria are in the soil.
Yep.
So, you know, and we do suggest that. There are some soils that are really poor, and if you want to speed the process up, we suggest that. We've been known to tell people just go to your neighbor's compost or your own and just throw some of that in with it. You were talking about different things that you add with your biochar to charge it. Now, you use the word inoculate, and we tend to use the term charge just because we think of it as non-biological versus biological.
Unless it's a biological, then it would be inoculation.
Inoculate, exactly. Yeah. The biochar is, if it's a good biochar, has all those pores that you see on the screen. And so it's either going to have mostly filled or it's going to pull, and it's going to pull the nutrients. But if they check back, 2 years later, 3 years later, it would be great.
Yeah.
But it would literally inoculating and charging in the soil, and the soil would be having to put it together. Yeah. Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense. It has an ability to adsorb nutrient and to attract microorganisms. So
air, water, food,
when
biology.
You dump it in the soil and it's naked, because that's the term y'all use for it when you're buying it, right? Then it's going to start doing that with what's in the soil, and it's going to do that till it's, like you said, charged up. It's going to attract microbes, and then they're going to set up shop, and then it's going to start doing exchanges. Because one of the reasons that I feel that it does such a good job of longevity for soil is so that little tiny fleck of biochar has massive surface area, and it's now holding on to tons of all these macro and micronutrients, and now it takes work to get that nutrient off of it. So the little critter can do the work.
Exactly.
And a little critter makes a bargain with the plant: squirt some exudate out, give me some sugar, and I'll give you some selenium, or I'll give you some manganese, or I'll give you some calcium. And so then that natural relationship that's supposed to be there is required.
Can I touch on that?
Sure. That's why you're here.
Thank you. I think the whole cycle, the whole process is so awesome. The exudates, and you can also see the word photosynthates in there too. Some people might use that in that up to 30% of the plant, what the plant makes, the sugars, flavonoids, enzymes, amino acids, it's a whole slurry. And this is really cool, and this is what gets me excited, is that the plant does that, and the flavonoids are actually messenger molecules to communicate beyond the plant's root systems. And so the plant puts this out, And it draws in the microbes and it brings in, you know, build it and they will come. Does anybody know that anymore? What's that one Kevin Costner show?
Yeah.
Build it and they will come. So it does that. Now, I was just reading recently that sometimes the plant will actually pull back some of its exudates from the soil. Isn't that crazy? So that was very fascinating. But this is what the plant is doing. The plant is communicating and providing this environment, this rhizosphere, to create populations. And they want to make it super, super dense, because the denser it is, the less pathogenic and other unbeneficial types of microbes can come in. They want to elbow them out and just overload it. And so, but now, so what we have seen, so that's exciting in and of itself. But then the plant also will change the exudate that it's putting. The ratios will change so that it can change its populations as the plant goes through the season. So at the early parts, if it's a new plant or if the plant's setting buds to make a flower, to make a fruit, whatever you want to call it, the plant changes that. And if there's some kind of a stressor, the plant will change its exudates, and it could be literally from the biology changing, and because they're communicating up as well. They are communicating as well. As they can tell, and they have a farther reach than the plant does. They may know about issues coming way beyond the plant. They may be the first guards to alert the plant, and then the plant can actually be initiated to create defensive responses. It's really fascinating on that. Then we take one more thing. So we have been recently, and I did include this in the link, we've been doing a microbiometer, and that's really cool. It's really nice to be able to send your soils and stuff out to get data for that. But you can do it real fast and quick, and you can get the fungal bacterial ratio, and you can get an overall microgram data. And then you can compare that. And what we've been doing with our clients for the last year and a half or so is we've been going to some of their properties, and we've been doing control and after applications. Mm-hmm. And we've seen a huge difference in the microbiology of the soil after the a biochar blend application. But I'm talking fast. I got to slow down. So here's the really cool part that we've observed. If you take those rates, if you take that data, throughout this year, we've seen, now it's always, yay, it's always that our treated soils always are higher, but it changes. So sometimes the biology is a higher amount, and sometimes the biology is a lower amount. And I now also understand that sometimes the exudates can be pulled. It's not stagnant. It's not consistent. No. It is active.
It is. And what's cool about that, Jack, is this. When we're going back out to, let's just say, blueberry fields, you know, mm-hmm. So we'll go out there in the spring, right when that plant is first taking off and starting to grow, and we'll get a measurement of the microbiology in the soil. And it may be at 800 angstrom, what is it, milligram? I can't remember right now. Do we have that slide on there?
Mm-hmm. No, not there.
So let's just say this. It may be like 800 on this scale. And then we move into the vegetative state. So now we're into like June, you know, July or so. And we're at like 1,000. And then we move to harvest time, September, October. And what's happened now, that plant is done calling for nutrients for the fruit. It's completely changing what it's doing. And all of a sudden you'll see that those levels of biology start dropping down to 680, 700. It's fascinating. So they're interacting with the plant. And that's one thing that, like I always tell folks, we know more about a dog's in digestion than we know about the soil we're walking on. And
the moon.
And yeah, well, it's just an amazing thing. So
the dog's digestion's good.
Yeah, dog's digestion's good.
Everybody's just about dog's digestion.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense that there would be cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Seasonally, and that seasonally it would change based on the plant, because different plants have different cycles. And if you think about it, it's not much different than the way humans were before we had a supermarket on every corner. You know, in times past, the abundance was the spring and the fall,
mm-hmm.
you know, and summer you laid around in the sun. And so you built up all this vitamin D. And then by the time you went into winter and there's going to be a time of scarcity, hopefully you'd put a little fat on. That was your battery. And then you dumped like the vitamin D and other nutrients stored in your fat into your body during a time where you had to naturally fast. Like plants do the same thing. If you think about just a regular deciduous tree, what happens in the fall? The leaves turn color and all the sugars drop into the roots, and that's the fuel for the spring. And it's creating a battery. One of the things I would say is everything is a battery for something. You know, water's a battery. Soil's a battery. Root mass is a battery. Biochar is a battery. And so if you have a battery-based system, and every system is in some way, otherwise it has no – if you don't have a battery, you have no sustainability. You go one day without something you need, you're dead, right? Like, not want, need. So everything's a battery-based system. So you're going to have a draw and recharge.
Yeah.
I never thought of it as to the exudate exchange, but, yeah, of course, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, so you had asked a question earlier on, you mentioned surface area. And so our biochar, just as a side note, we had a lot of choices, and we didn't want to just put black in the soil. And so we chose it's a little more expensive, but it's very effective. And, you know, biochar is going to last a minimum of 600 to 1,000 years. It's changing the structure of the soil by adding to it. But one of the things that we will tell people is the biochar really is just the scaffolding. The real change in the soil is the biology. Thank you for that. The biology is what's actually changing the pH. The biology is holding the granules together so you get more an aggregation. The biology, the biofilm of the bacteria and the glomulin of the fungi and the burrowing of the earthworms and everything else as it comes, build it and they will come, creates a soil that allows water to move through, that releases nutrients and also holds nutrients. So, you know that whole thing we were talking about fertilizer and what was the percent you mentioned that's now being held in the soil?
I don't want to quote it exactly in my head. It's 13% going into the plant. It could be less than that.
There
was a range, but the aggregate average was about 13% ends up in the plant and the rest of it lays in the soil or erode, and most of it ends up eventually in groundwater.
Leaches out. Yeah. So that's held. One of the things that you have to tell agriculture about their inputs. That's really exciting.
Oh, yeah. I want to talk about that, Jack. But if you could pull up, there's a picture that I think is titled The 7-Day Study.
No, he didn't get that one.
We never get that?
No, they didn't get that one. Sorry.
Okay, well, you didn't get that one. Sorry about that.
All right.
But I want to touch on this because I think Lori started going down a path about why we choose the biochar we choose.
Oh yeah, and I didn't
finish
that.
The first thing I'll say about that, we want people to make biochar and use biochar, even if it's out of whatever they can. It doesn't matter.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
But for us, because we're science minded, and on both companies they're science based companies, right? Plant Growth Management Systems and the American Biochar. So when I got to the agricultural side, I realized that I had to somehow make this as cost effective as possible. I had to think like a businessman. So make it as cost effective as possible, make the efficacy the same or better than what we have with the granular, and reduce the amount of product we had to put on the field dramatically.
The product and or the inputs.
And well, the product. Now the inputs. What we normally say on the, and by the way, that's what I would like to talk about how we did that, but not right now. But what Lori's question was, I think, was, or your comment was, what about the inputs that are farming? Mm-hmm. We beg the farmers, or anybody, turf folks, I don't care. We beg them to at least cut their inputs by 25% to 30%, at least. Because we make it that much more efficient. So even a crude type charged biochar will do the same thing.
It reduces the leach.
So that means that we don't, if it is only 13%, Jack, getting to the plant itself, you know, what we're doing right now, we proved it, that if you cut your NPK, or your, they like to call them nutrients,
you cut your
nutrients back by 35-40%, you're going to end up with a, with more in your pocket at the end of the season because you haven't spent money on it. Your soil is going to be healthier. The plant is going to be healthier to eat. So, I mean, this is it's exciting to us, you know. And the cool thing about it is that we've been doing this long enough, and we've had data and tests from Northern California to Missouri to Texas to Oklahoma to Michigan, Ohio, Florida, Haiti. You know, it doesn't matter what soil type we're putting it on. It doesn't matter what plant. The responses are the same.
I think that one of the things that I've heard from people about biochar as well, my soil's good. I don't need biochar or what have you. Like, I have great results already. And my response has always been, so are you saying that every year when you're planting, whether it's your garden or your farm or your market garden, whatever you're planting, you don't add any fertilizer, you don't add any soil amendments, you don't add any compost, and everything's great? Because if the answer to that is, no, I don't add anything and everything's fantastic, okay, fine. Otherwise, you're adding amendments, you're adding cost, you're adding material, and you're losing a lot of it. Even if it's great or in a great organic operation, if you're adding stuff every year, you're admitting that your battery is being discharged every year. And what we're talking about here, I like this term. I like the coral reef that I've been using, but this battery, to hold on to it so that it has more longevity, hence more resiliency. And then we always also add in the whole, you know, 7 pounds of water to a pound of seven gallons of biochar is the water retention capacity. So if you don't ever water, okay, fine, you don't even, right? But if you ever water, then you need to at least look at this and consider this.
Yeah.
Hey, Jack, would you do me a favor? Now I know we have this picture on the link or on the scroll. Would you go to that picture of the prairie fire, please?
The what?
Should be a prairie fire.
Oh, yes. I know which one you mean. Hold on.
Yeah. Okay, Matt, there you go. Okay, now I want to talk about this for a minute because
this,
by
the way, is a blow your mind thing we were talking about.
Okay.
In 2015, we didn't do this because we didn't know how to do it because we were too old. But my daughter did a YouTube blast for us when we were getting ready for the first shipment going to the island of Loganav in Haiti. And it was to get people involved in what we were doing and bring the community in and help us prepare and you know, create the biochar and bagging and everything. And I realized, and I thought we were going to get a whole bunch of 16, 15, 18-year-old kids. I thought this would be awesome. They're going to teach them a lot. They're going to learn a lot. I got 8 and 9-year-old little girls, and one little girl was like 5. And then 2 mothers who were younger than about my son's age. And I thought, oh, my gosh, how am I going to teach these kids what we're doing? How do you teach a 9-year-old or an 8-year-old? So I had them we're in the warehouse office right now, and we looked out the window over here, and I said, what do you see out here in the front of this place? And he said, a bunch of grass and a tree. I said, yeah. I said, do you see sticks and leaves, or do I get those picked up, or do I keep it mowed? Well, there's no leaves out there. And I says, yeah, now in your yard, are there sticks and leaves, or does your mom and dad pick it up for you? Well, yeah, we don't want to step on sticks. I said, okay, kids, this is the thing. Those leaves, those branches, those sticks, that is part of that carbon that should be going back in the soil. And of course, carbon, I had to explain that too, but that's that process, and we stop that process. Now, that right there. So when I was at Purdue in forestry, one of the classes we took was forest fire management. And that was in 1981 or something like that, too. I don't know. It was a while ago. But when's the last time we had what we hear about forest fires on the West Coast in California because of all the damage you do? This is a natural occurrence. And when you stop this, when you truncate a natural occurrence, you're right there is a semi-fixed biochar carbon and a food source for the biology going back in there. And that used to occur every year, sometimes 3 or 4 times a year. And in Michigan, where we are right now, we had some major fires in the 1800s.
It was part of the natural cycle.
And so you're wondering, and then the question is, well, I don't have to add biochar back to my, because my yard looks great. Well, yeah, but here's the thing. We just got done talking about the nickels and whatever, about the we've lost about 40% of our, or actually 70% of our fixed carbon in the soil. So that means that when you truncate the natural process, even if you're putting a pittance of biochar in your soil, you're more so replicating what would normally occur in a natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no just stopping it.
And so the coral reef, the soil reef, that whole idea of creating what we call fixed carbon. Your compost and everything else is always an active carbon breaking down, but it's the fixed carbon that has, as you mentioned, has been suppressed in the natural cycle of all soils. And I think that was really like, wow.
Well, that's just what it is.
And so.
Yeah. I mean, they said that to live among the Native Americans prior to colonization was to live among continuous fire.
Yeah.
They were always burning everything. And I think people have this idea that when a forest burns, all the trees burn down. And those are people that have never been to a mature forest, because you walk around a mature forest and all the mature trees have char on the outside of their bark. They can stand right through that. I remember Bill Mollison said, you want to stop the spread of fire on your land, plant a whole bunch of walnut trees, and the class laughed. He said, go take a match out and try to set a mature one on fire. And when you burn your fingers, come back and tell me about it. Some of these trees, like the big giants of the forest, like the sequoias, they will not even produce seed until they're exposed to smoke.
I was at a talk, and the lady was discussing the fact that the forest practices where they don't cut down everything and they don't keep it clear.
Yeah.
Actually, it's worse for trees with fires, because then it actually creates the fuel source so that it can actually reach the higher parts of those trees and actually damage them. So even the forest management has not always been, they need to clean them up a little bit. They need to let fires go through.
Yeah. So we're not going to change this, because that's how it is in the United States right now.
Yeah.
We have to understand that we have to be proactive in adding a fixed carbon back into our soils.
Yeah.
Or we're basically doomed to it's heading the same direction. So
yeah. So a question that you had asked earlier that we kind of got sidetracked on. So we utilize our biochar. We utilize the fact that people should, any kind of biochar is wonderful, because we do provide for others. If they're not going to make their own biochar, we're doing that, and large amounts for agriculture. We've got some really great tree companies, arborists who use it as well, and so good for that rural and urban forests where the soil, we started out with that. What a great carbon base. That was his light bulb moment on that. And but the biochar we use is, the feedstock's always the same. It's southern yellow pine. And that pine is a soft wood, so you don't have to get too high of a temperature to clean out those pores, all those vesicles, xylem, phloem, yada, yada. And so it's really consistent. We know what to expect. The temperature's consistent. You don't want to go too high, because you can make the biochar fragile. Mm-hmm. You don't want it to too fast, because it might not be completely cleaned out. The porosity of ours is it one 6-gallon, 5-gallon container that you can get from Menards full of our biochar is over 500 acres of surface area.
Hmm.
Wow. It's big. It's good. So that's something that pride ourselves on.
Yep.
What is y'all's process for char? Like, where is it coming from? Are y'all making it yourselves? Are you outsourcing that? How's it being made?
All right. Right now, because we're getting this, we're sourcing southern yellow pine. We're using different pyrolysis plants down in southern states. So basically, we're talking about the Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama.
Okay.
Obviously. Now, the reason we don't feel bad about that is, number one, the biochar, they're not just using a pyrolysis plant to create biochar. Biochar is the waste material.
Yes. Yes.
Along with wood vinegar, you know. So diesel. And diesel fuel.
Wood vinegar.
Use that too. But heat. But heat. So it's a lot more cost effective to put 11 ton in or 13 ton in of chipped southern yellow pine and get 1 ton out of biochar and ship that 1 ton up here.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Absolutely.
Otherwise, we've got a carbon footprint that's about as big as Godzilla.
Well, and so, we use recycled.
So, yeah, basically, there's nothing that we're cutting down. These are the waste materials.
No, if it's yellow pine, it's the slash and trimming.
Exactly. But we can do the same thing, and we are helping folks get pyrolysis plants set up like this. In fact, that's the meeting I was just on before this one. It was about an hour and a half or so of that conversation. But that's another topic in itself.
Production needs to stay, I guess you'd call it decentralized, because if we start centralizing production, now we're moving waste.
Yep.
And the waste, the yield is about 30% by volume, and it's less by weight, in my understanding. Mm-hmm. Right? So you can ship so much more once it's produced for so much less. That makes sense.
Exactly.
If you took a little bitty bag, a couple gallons of it, you're talking about a massive amount of waste. So we want to locate production as closely to the feedstock as we can. And that's why I think everybody with a homestead should be making some of their own, because you have feedstock.
Yep.
If you are a homesteader, if you are a significant size gardener, if you have fruit trees, if you trim, like I have these live oaks that constantly sprout new things off their trunks and smack you in the face and cut your eyeballs out, and I only got one good one, so I can't afford to lose that, and I prune that every year, and it's like people are like, you have a chipper shredder. Yes, I do, but those branches, even if I wanted to chipper shred them, it would be more work to get them in that chipper shredder and to make biochar, because they're not like this. They're freaking crazy in the way they're shaped. So everybody has something. People that live in the suburbs, you can get all the feedstock you want every fall by walking around and picking up everybody's perfectly little bundled piles, because the cities won't take them away unless they're in, less than 3 foot. So there's just all this material everywhere. And I've got a cone kiln, but as I started researching, I'm like, you use a freaking 55-gallon drum with a saddle cut in it, and you can make literal tons of this stuff of stuff that's just laying around.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's this
any biomass.
Yeah, yeah, and I think what I like best about when I look at companies like yours and similar companies is, sure, you can buy just plain biochar, but the stuff that's already charged up. Because I think the other thing that I've pushed back on one of my friends, a contemporary kind of in the whole permaculture teaching space, that's like, I see no need for this. I live in a northern climate with stable soils. And I'm like, and this guy's on and on all the time about people being able to cultivate microorganisms and like a place that's not got certain ones, being able to move them in. I'm like, there's nothing better to move a microorganism from one property to the other than inoculated biochar. It's a safe space, right? They can go in there and pet their puppies and eat their ice cream. They're safe in there. And I think, because these guys are like gremlins. They're a bright light, mogwai. They don't like light. They like dark. They like cool. They like moist. And so inoculated, charged up char, and especially like a compost char combo, if you want to start supercharging your microbes, sourcing somebody who has that, that's the way to go, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Would you do me a favor, Jack? Would you pull up the two parks at Rancho Cordova, California.
Yep.
And we'll get to the one in Haiti in a minute. I'll go back to the other one. There you go. Stop. All right. This is such a good visual. And because people are visual, we all are visual people. This is an example of what you can do with, I think we're at one cubic yard per thousand. Or 1 cubic foot per thousand.
Yeah, okay.
This is just seven gallons. Yeah, this was just topically applied. We started this in 2015, and this picture is from 2018. So the first year application was 2015. So in 15, 16, 17, 18. So you can visually see the difference. Now, if you go to the next picture, which had the core, soil core.
Soil core.
Right there. This is what happened. Now, I want you to look at, see that, can you, I'm hoping everybody can see this, but you see how loose that core is, that soil core is? You see how it's fractured down there at the bottom? Okay. We literally took this horrid, horrid soil, and this park was, I think, 5 years old when we started, and the rooting depth was at maximum 2 inches. The only way they were keeping this alive was with fertilizer and water, obviously. So all we did was very quickly get that rooting depth down to 10 inches in 14 months, basically a year and a half in California. So for us, it would be about 2 years because it's California never cools down. You would probably be the same down where you are too, Jack, because your soil doesn't get that cold. So you get the same result down there. But then you have to ask yourself, what's going on here? So we reduce our need for watering by at least 30% or 40%. The nitrogen was cut by 25%, and yet we can still do that, which you see in front of you. Now, if you go to – do we have that one up there, which is the
– No, we don't.
Oh, okay. Well, here's the data behind what's happening here. So I believe it was Gerald Dobbs at the time that was out there when we started this. He used to be in charge of Michigan State University. Then he was in charge of Rancho Cordova.
He's down in Texas now.
Now he's down in your state, down in UTEP. So he's running University of Texas El Paso. But when we started this, I kept getting the questions, how is this biochar getting all the way down through the soil? It doesn't make any sense to us because you're just applying it on the top. You're not doing anything. And I said, it's the biology, folks.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the biochar. The biochar is not – biochar by itself is not the great answer. Biology is the answer. So we had an increase in total bacteria of 29% in one season. We had an increase of actually in 7 days. We had an increase in 5,000% of flagellate. Now, if you – which are the little critters that work in the soil –
mm-hmm.
Look at that soil core analysis that we took. It's all broke up. The only way that happens is by biology. Those are the 5,000% increase of the flagellates that are loosening that soil and then allowing water to percolate down
and
through the soil.
And the roots
soil.
Are following so, through so we're and not, breaking up stuff
So we're
too.
Not evaporating that water off. The biology is producing a glomulin, which helps hold the water. So we increase our fungi by 50% nitrogen. Then we have an extra 100% increase in nitrogen, natural nitrogen.
That was there already.
So it was there. We didn't add it. But so that's the beauty of it. But this picture, to me, speaks volumes.
Well, think about it this way, right? So I'm a plant, and I have some level of innate intelligence. I'm not going to anamorphize plant, right? It doesn't think like a human, but it does have some innate intelligence. And I need nutrients. I need water, and I need, for my root systems, I need oxygen, right? If I have packed hard pan soil and down below 2 inches, there is no water, there is no nutrient, and it's anaerobic, I'm not putting any effort into going down there.
No.
But if little critters start going down there, I will chase them.
Right.
Right? And we do this in some of our, like, wicking bed systems just with water, or ebb and flow systems, when we start plants, we'll bring the water level way, way up, like way higher than you'd want it, but there's no roots yet. And then every day we'll lower that level.
Yep.
And those plants will chase that water. Well, if you've got water, nutrient, and air, they'll really chase that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just the same principle. And so now the microbe and the plant are working as a team, penetrating deeper down into the soil. I don't know how far they'll ever go here because literally the deepest spot I have on this property is 11 inches. And then I have slab limestone and I'm doing everything I have with slab. Like this place I live 50 million years ago was underneath something called the Great Inland Sea, which went from the Gulf of Mexico to the North Sea. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have so much oil and gas around here. It's all ocean bed. And you dig down and the first layer of rock is a conglomerate of limestone and seashells.
Yep.
It looks exactly like concrete rubble.
Yep.
It's natural concrete. And when you pull that off with an excavator, the next level looks like what you could cap the pyramids with. It's pure white. And we grow here. And biochar is new for us. We've been doing it all just with biology. Like we're looking forward to what we can do is we've just incorporated this in the last 60 days.
Cool. Yeah. Okay. So where do you want to go from here?
Let's talk a little bit about people making their own. I think that's something my audience would be really interested in. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, like I said earlier, I would love, and when I'm giving presentations and we have, you know, 600 people in the audience,
yeah,
I'm begging people, don't just wait, you know, for companies like us to make biochar, because we will do it. We'll do it very well. But there's no reason why everybody who has the opportunity to do it, why they can't do it themselves. And I would highly recommend that if you're going to charge it with something, and it's going to be multiple things with charging, that could be animal waste, or it could be compost tea, or it could be humate, or it could be it could be compost.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Understand that it may act a little bit differently every year. Your results may vary slightly every year. And don't be upset about that, because it took us a lot of effort to try to create something that is very science-based, where we can write a protocol up and say, if you use it exactly this way, this is the result you're going to get. But don't be discouraged. If it's like 1 year is fantastic, and the next year it's like, it's looking good, but it's not as good as last year, don't worry, because your soil is going to keep getting better and better and better. So no matter what, I would say, even if it's the most rudimentary thing, like food waste, I mean, just whatever you can use.
And not get stressed about the pH either.
No, and do not stress out about pH. And that's something that I would like to talk about a little bit.
Okay. Yeah, let's talk about that, because it's alkaline. I'm like, first of all, everything's alkaline. The rain's alkaline. The house is alkaline. The dog's alkaline. It's alkaline. The air's alkaline. The stream water's alkaline. My pool water's alkaline. So I'm not worried about it, but some people are. And I think that it doesn't really move the needle much on the soil pH.
It doesn't. As a matter of fact, can I cover this?
Yes, please.
As a matter of fact, back in the day in my soil science classes at Purdue, and that was just the inkling. You know, at college, you just sort of learn a little bit, and you learn a lot more after you get out. But we were always taught that pH was so critical. You know, you want a pH that's 7.72 if you're going to grow the best, so forth. That is so wrong.
Or 6.8.
The pH, number one, we can't modify the soil's pH. We cannot. Long term, we can't.
Yeah, I was going to say, short term, we understand, people learn stuff, but
you can have a slight,
the bigger picture.
Short term, you can have a slight modification, but it's only going to be right around the area you put that biochar in. It is not going to have any permanent effect. It can't. Mm-hmm. But what it will do is it will increase the biology. And the reason, and do we have the blueberry picture up there or anything, Lori?
We do have the blue. What, do you want the nutrient density or do you want the biology?
Let's do the biology.
Okay. You do have the biology for the blueberries and apples.
Is
okay.
That
one more.
Or the prior one. Prior
that one. Great.
Okay.
Thank
you. Now I want you to think about this for a minute. Blueberry plants. If you talk to any grower, they'll say, I like a 4.8 to 5.2 on pH scale. That's about the sweet spot. Guess what? I grow blueberries on my own property. My pH is 7.2. How am I doing that? By what you're looking at here. Because we're looking at this isn't on my property, but if you look.
You can see it.
Thank you. Yeah, my eyes aren't that good. But if you look at the respiration test, which is talking about the total amount of soil microbe populations, we had an increase on one of the fields of 76.9%, an increase of blueberry on another field of 41.2%. Now, I know the before was terrible, but my point here is that it's the biology that is bad. When you're on a low pH soil, you have more bacteria and less fungi.
That's right.
When you're a higher pH soil, you have much less bacteria and more fungi. Blueberry interact with bacteria, not fungi. That's why they think you can't grow blueberry on a low pH or on a high pH. But when you get a good balance of bacteria and fungi, even in a 7.2 soil, you grow fantastic blueberries. So it's not the pH. Don't worry about it.
And the plant and the soil are going to coordinate to get it to where it's best. And because poor guy, he's asking us to talk about biochar, and we keep on talking about other stuff. Yeah. But the biochar is going to support that. The biochar is going to set it up. I would love for you, Jack, to ask him what amazing things we found. Amazing things we found out about micronizing. Why a large piece of biochar is good, but we have started. We have the liquid where we put it in with liquid humate, and then we have it micronized. We have it milled down to less than 5 micron size, and we get better results with that.
That's awesome. I think there is a case for it being a variety of sizes. And I will say this. Yes. I was terrified to try this because everybody on YouTube said it would cause my entire neighborhood to be in a black cloud of smoke. They are wrong. If you're making it at home and you have a good chipper shredder, you absolutely can put it through a chipper shredder.
With a mask.
No, there was no problem. Now, this was fully quenched char where it was completely covered with water and then drained. And 2 days after the quench, when it was still had a good moisture amount, if you wet it at that point, it will make paste and you will spend a long time cleaning out your chipper shredder. Mm-hmm. But if you give it about 2 days after quench, it goes in, it comes out, and fine little granules. And my chipper shredder I have has a chute that goes straight into it's designed to take a 32-gallon steel trash can and stick it right under it. It blows right into it. And all I had to do was throw a piece of military surplus tarp over it because it throws so hard it was bouncing out. And I took 5-gallon buckets, dumped it in the big chute, out, done. And then my thing to clean out the chipper shredder, I take some heavy wood chips, throw them in there run an ice through your meat grinder to just clean it out, and boom. So, let's talk about micro size. But I did want to point that out when you said that it triggered that memory that I had the last time I talked about it, I said, do not put this in a chipper shredder. And
now you change your mind.
Michael Whitman from Blue Sky, he recommends the steel vacuums, and they're like $300. And I'm like, I've got this $2,000 chipper sitting here. If it messes up, it messes up. It was fine. But don't get it too wet or it makes black paste. Anyway, micro size.
Okay, so what – and this was the results we got from this was actually totally accidental. So don't think we're that smart. All I tried to do was find a way to apply a charged carbon biochar on multiple acres at a cost
effective. That's that management thing.
The management side. So I'm going to attempt this.
Oh,
would you hold that? Just follow me here. It's okay.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so this is – well, first you're going to drink this.
All right. We're going to go.
This is the wet mill down to 5 micron. Yeah, it's all over the place now. So that is charged biochar.
Okay.
All right? So this will stay in suspension once you have it in the tank. But the thing about this that shocked us is that we thought that our larger – the typical – larger biochar would hold more water, would have more nutrient, build more a microbes.
Larger is better, we thought.
We were wrong.
Not so.
This week, when with our testing, this came out to this type of biochar, charged carbon, actually held 46.3% more water once it was in the soil. Now think about and anybody can do this, by the way. If you take your biochar. We did this when we were in Haiti. I'll show you a picture of that in a minute. But you can take, if you don't have, you can't wet mill it, just grind it down. Take some big cinder block, flat block, and grind it.
Didn't you say something about driving over it? You were doing
that. Yeah, that was what everybody said to do was drive over it, and then I put it through quarter-inch hardware mesh, and then I did that 3 more times, and then I was like, I think I'm going to dump it in a chipper shredder and see what happens. And, for the bulk production, that's what's going to happen from now on, because I went through 4 buckets of it in about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was done, and it went from 4 buckets to about 3 buckets in finished product, because it sat, it's like putting number 7 shot versus number 6 shot in a shotgun shell. one's going to hold more pellets, you know.
Right.
But it works really good. But I see what you're saying here. I like analogies. It helps the audience get things in their head. It's kind of like making compost tea with biochar, even though it isn't, because it's a different reason. But what I mean by that is if I make a cubic yard of compost, I can put that across, you know, 20 garden beds. Or I can make buckets of freaking compost tea, and I can spray pasture with that.
Yep.
I can get the benefit in that pasture of spreading compost, but it costs less to do because I'm spreading it easier. And this is not the same. It's an analogy. It's not, you know, it's not the same. It's like, by doing what you're saying, you can apply it on a broader scale for a more economical ROI. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. And of course, everything has to have a return on investment, right? It has to work. So what we know now is that what we can do with 1.5 ounces of the liquid micronized charged biochar is equivalent to 30 granular ounces of our.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so we're almost a 30 to 1 ratio.
It's actually higher than that.
I know, but it's close enough. So that means that on agriculture, we can go out and we can apply 1 to 1.5 gallons per acre. Per acre.
1.5 gallons per acre.
1.5 gallons per acre.
The concentrate in the water,
yeah,
obviously.
Exactly. So now I want you to think about this for a minute. For everybody that's watching this, this is such a hard concept to understand, but look at it this way. If you had a roll of dimes, and that roll of dimes was biochar, you would have the surface area on the outside of that roll, on the horizontal outside, and you'd have the surface area on the ends. That's what you'd have. That would be your biochar.
Done.
All right. Now take the paper off that roll and throw those dimes on the table.
Okay.
Now you've exposed, what, 30, 40, 50, 60, 80 times more surface area? So now you have more surface area for microbes to interact with. You have more surface area for water to adhere to. And you have more surface area for
oxygen.
To capture
inputs.
The farmer's inputs and not let them go away. So if you can just think about it that way, I like to put analogies where it's back to just common sense stuff. So picture that roll of dimes. Look at it. Think that's my surface area. That's the power of my biochar. Take those dimes out and throw them on the floor.
And just to be clear for everybody listening, he's not saying it's just ground up biochar. It's biochar with the inoculum, with the charging of microorganisms. So in a way, is it basically super finely milled biochar mixed with compost tea? Is that basically what it is?
Oh, yeah, that's great together.
Well, that is.
Compost tea and that together is
great. And here's the other thing. Of course, you always have to think, well, can some of the farmers that are on the dry, dry plains, if you go up into southwest Kansas, southeast Colorado, the whole area where basically water is is the biggest problem, and your yields are going to be a lot less out there, but you can still improve the soil and get it really healthy.
Yeah.
And good yields with less inputs. But so what we do out there is they're not going to buy a micronized, some of them are, but a micronized Vital Blend 5M, which is a charged carbon. You can take an uncharged, what you call naked 5M,
Char
5M. So you can take that and you add it to your manure slurry.
Yeah.
Or you can add it to your compost tea. Or you can add it to whatever. So then their cost goes way down, right? And they're getting the same kind of benefit. So that's what I'm saying to your viewers. You guys can do this yourselves. To make your own biochar, get a couple cinder blocks. I know this sounds archaic, but trust me, it works. I've done it. Put your biochar down there. Put sand it between two cinder blocks and rub the cinder blocks against each other.
That's what you did down in Haiti.
That's what I had to do in Haiti. And then take that back out and then add that to your water solution and charge it with whatever you want to charge it with. You'll do the same exact thing, more or less, that we've done with our micronized 5M.
And so to pull in that tall grass prairie burning that we were talking about earlier on, One of our salespeople were discussing. So at what point in time, if it's not going anywhere, it's going to last for, you know, over 800 years, yada, yada. When do you stop? And Mark made that perfect. And that's when Mark brought up the whole point of in nature, it was a common thing to happen. So you don't stop. But what you can do is you can reduce your amounts.
Yep. So, the nice thing about this is it doesn't take science to figure this out. I'm telling you right now, walk on your ground. Take your shoes off, take your socks off, walk on the ground. You can feel the difference when it starts getting healthy. And if you wanted to, you can do a core analysis or whatever, but just feel the soil. Put a shovel in it. You know, you'll see it.
And then feel it. Touch it, smell it.
Smell it,
yeah.
Every person, a greenhorn is get out from farming or whatever. And when you show them good soil, there's an intrinsic knowledge that humans have. Because
I think it is intrinsic. I agree with you.
Right.
I think
we evolved as a species in touch with the earth. And so there's a thing that you look at soil and you just know that's good soil.
Yeah.
Right. And when you look at bad, crappy soil, you also go, that's bad, crappy soil. Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I know you guys know what I'm talking about. You pick it up, you smell it. You're like, oh, that's right. And definitely like my eastern section of my property is where we did a food forest. When we moved in 10 years ago. And it was a couple, 3 years into where when you walked through the inner swales of where the trees are, you went from walking on this hard, compacted crap to basically you were walking on a firm mattress.
Mm-hmm.
And you could feel it. You could just tell when you walked on it that something had changed. And it was that year that everything exploded, like just everything went.
It does. It takes some time sometimes. It takes some time. At our website, there is one section where you can go to our blogs. And we've been so busy, I haven't been able to do blogs recently, and I really enjoyed that. But there's a couple blogs people might be interested in reading. One of them is talking about walking barefoot and being in good soil, and there is actually and getting your hands dirty. There's another one talking about that and how Research Center. Yeah. Thank you. And talking about that there's actual bacteria that actually can help with mood, improving your mood and reducing depression, which is why in coming back circles, there's so many circles, it's so cool. Why coming back to cities and re-soiling the cities and getting trees in. There was a study that said you can have a park, a green area, but if you add a minimum of 30% of that area with trees, it really increased the amount of phytochemicals that people came in contact with, and they could actually gauge an increase in of depression. It was very helpful. Just really, we are so connected, as you mentioned.
So it's cool.
Let's take some questions from the audience. We have quite a few starting to back up. This one might not be good. Nope, this one's fine. I did my first run of biochar. I'm using a method with a barrel inside a barrel and a chimney. I'm going to run a second time because it's not carbonized. Not all carbonized, but high M. I don't get the IM. I think what he's saying is he made a T-blood, or else he made a retort like a tin man. I'm not sure which one he's really saying, but he didn't get full carbonization.
To me,
with that barrel inside a barrel system, I think it's the tin man retort. It probably means the material inside the barrel was, if it was like wood chips or something, it's too dense, or you didn't get good airflow about your outer burn. It would be
moist,
y'all think. Or moisture, yeah. Like wood chips, especially, man, it's hard to dry them out.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep, I know. When we're going through paralysis, we're usually looking at trying to get the water content down to below 20%. So if it's a little bit wet, you're going to have that section that's not going to paralyze.
I've found with the wood chips especially, I have metric tons of them. But they don't do real well. But when you're doing like an open kiln, like a cone kiln or a barrel kiln or something like that, what I'll do is I'll take about 5 5-gallon buckets of wood chips and I'll have them sitting there. And when that burns like 80% to where it's at capacity, I'll start adding small amounts at that point. And there's so much heat.
Yep.
When you're at that stage,
drying
it drives that moisture. So you're not going to do a ton of wood chips that way, but it's a way to make use of that smaller stock. And what I ended up doing was going from a place where you kind of had this lumpy texture, so there was a lot of space left in the kiln when you quenched it, to you literally filled the kiln. Like you got everything you could get out of it. It seems to have made really good char, but I haven't made one of those retort style ones yet, so I can't speak to it at all. Mm-hmm.
Well, the questions.
Yeah, we can go back to this has nothing to – oh, wait. It doesn't really have anything to do with biochar. Hanging long, you heard my idea for black soldier fly worms and biochar the other day. Anyway, to do black soldier flies up in zone 4. Not a soldier fly expert, but it's just a matter of their life cycle time and whether you're warm enough for them long enough. I don't know about zone 4 and black soldier fly. Though. I don't know if that's too far north. I don't know if y'all know anything about soldier flies.
No, I don't.
So I don't know. Find out if anybody does them in your area. Discuss, I think, is what he meant to say. Biochar feedstock, pros and cons. Are there certain feedstocks that are better or more optimum than others?
Yeah. Would you like us to cover that really quickly?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. And I think you actually touched on this in your last presentation, but the softwood, the conifers actually make a really good feedstock. They are the best. Oak makes a pretty good feedstock, but you have to burn it pretty hot to get all the lignins out and everything. So you end up with some ash. Yeah, I know. Yeah, volatiles, I'm sorry. And I mean, everything from switchgrass to rice hulls to now it's hemp fiber.
Okay.
But every time you get to a type of plant that you're using to pyrolysize, think about what it would look like. Is it under a microscope? And I know that's a hard thing to understand, I guess, but could you build, could you make a table out of rice hulls? You know, could you? Yeah, I know. So that's my point. Just think about that for a minute. Could you structurally build something out of some of this stuff? So the easiest way to explain it is if you think you could, that's probably going to make a better biochar.
And I would say what you're saying is the lead in, the feedstock provision of the pores. To us, the biochar is that carbonized structure that is going to hold as well as possible. Collapse doesn't support as much air pockets and things like that. So, it's going to have the biochar, even a less porous type feedstock, is still going to be better than nothing at all.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So we don't want to poo-poo any of them. But since the question is some feedstocks make a better biochar? Yes, they do.
I think it's a function of what are you going to do with the biochar.
Right.
Yeah. Everyone, we're talking about agricultural biochar, like woody stock is the way to go. And I guess there's some stuff in the middle that I'm not sure about. Like, you know, rice hulls, obviously, I think would go on the other side. But, like, I don't know, walnut shells.
Yes, walnut shells.
Like that. It's kind of woody. It's kind of something that I don't know. But then the stuff like corn stover and whatever they call it, the stuff from sugar cane left over and all that stuff like that. Like, to me, there's a lot of work being done now. They're finding that it's beneficial to add to, like, for paving for roads or in walls and structures to increase insulation and reduce EMF and stuff like that. Like, I think those feedstocks are, if they're going to be made to biochar, are better utilized for those types of things than for soil biology. Not that it won't help. It's just that we have so much woody feedstock that will help more than if I'm going to put it onto an agricultural concern, that's what I want to draw from.
Right. I think that makes sense. That and I also know that there's sometimes where, you know, and they control the timing and the temperatures with these things, and sometimes having some of the remaining volatiles and things like that in the plant from the plant material is beneficial. and it kind of creates kind of an environment that they might be trying to do.
Depends on what they're using.
Exactly. It really, two questions. What's your intent? What's your feedstock?
Yeah, and what do you have available, right?
And what do you have available?
Yeah, like if you live where there's no trees or very few trees, first plant some trees. Second, I understand that you're going to be drawing more from a more herbaceous type of feedstock at that point. Jeff T says, if I put biochar in compost tea with an air stone, is it better than just plain compost tea?
Oh my gosh.
My answer, I think, has already changed because of what you guys are doing with your micro biochar. Because I've always made the compost tea and then used it to, I haven't put them in the thing together, but with that liquid stuff, would you be able to take that approach?
Mm-hmm. First of all, Jeff, we have a gentleman that gave me a testimonial verbally, and he was saying that he added the Vital Blend 5M, so it was the 5 micron size. He said that it came to maturity, you know, when it gets to a point where it's done. I'm not a great
compost tea expert.
Yes, I'm not an expert on that, but he said it got to being done so much faster, and he said it started so much faster. He said it got bubbly a lot faster. What he was saying to me was he's like kind of shocked, and he wasn't ready to actually deal with it because it had processed it through so much faster. But here's the cool part too, and I wished I could have tested on this. This is extrapolation here, but can you imagine, Jeff and Jack, can you imagine having this biology, and here's where that inoculation part that we were talking about earlier too, having this biology that you put into the soil and you just do a compost tea, you always are going to have a certain percentage of the biology being exposed to air, light, et cetera, and die.
Yeah.
Okay. That just becomes the food for everybody else. Yay. But, cause they are cannibals. But if you could increase the protective aspect within the biology that's put into the soil so that your overall survivability of the biology we're trying to get into that soil, as well as the nutrients, increases. And we've seen that with walnuts in California. Is it walnuts?
Almonds. And Chandler walnut in California and almond. Yeah, but the funny thing is about that question, the answer to your question, Jeff T, is that, yeah, and it does. And it's because of the same stuff we were talking about. It's because of the increased microbiology. That's what's making that compost tea come into fruition much sooner.
But so your recommendation to do that, though, would be something more like your product or something that's milled to that fine consistency.
No.
Would you say to take, you know, fine grained out of my wood chipper straight into the compost tea bucket?
No.
I don't think that makes sense.
No, that doesn't make any sense at all. No, you'd have to do a little bit of work and grind that down. And here in a little bit, after we get some questions done, maybe I can pull up a picture that we have of Haiti, and I can talk about why, I can talk about what's going on there. But
we can do that right now.
Even if you don't have to. Okay, so go ahead and get to. Okay. All right. So this project, this is some of the worst soils we've been on. And this is on the island of Laganave in Haiti. Now, these plants, we didn't have a whole bunch of the granular biochar there at the time. It's a long story on this one. But this garden area is part of the Life Garden area. It's down by the sea shoreline on the island. And there is a 60-gallon rainwater tank we had that's back up to the in front of Natalie. That's Natalie, by the way, looking back. And all we did was we ground down the biochar, the vital blend, charged carbon, and because I didn't have anything with, and then we added that to the rain barrel. And every time they watered with the charged water. Right.
Oh.
I'm trying to, this is why I want to talk about this on your show.
No, I got
this,
it.
This is the stuff that people can do, right? So
if you're drip irrigating.
And yeah. Yes. Okay. So here's the thing. So this picture came because this was in 2000 and, I think 18 or so, maybe 19. I don't know. But I was talking with Natalie, and I said, Natalie, I'm only going to be here on the island for 2 more days. So if there's something that's not going well with you, with what we're doing, please let me know. And she says, oh, everything's fine. And I said, are you sure? And she paused. Now, it was in Haitian Creole, so I had to be, my interpreter was taking care of that noise. But she said, oh, there is one thing. I said, what's that? She said, I'll show you. I said, okay. So we walked through the garden area, and she knelt down, and she said, I'm afraid I have so much fruit on my plants, they're going to snap and fall over. And I says, Natalie, that's not a problem, sweetheart. That's one. All right. So I'm on every soil, on every plant type, no matter where we are, we're subtropical here. We've been up in, up in our tuffers. That's Haiti too. That's actually, those were citrus trees that were planted with the vital blend granular. And those were only not even 2 years old.
Wow.
We have been able we have data that shows that the health of the plant is so great by the biochar aiding it that they come to harvest sooner.
Yep. Okay. Now, but I do want to go back to that, Jack, because if somebody said, hey, I have rain barrels, I can slap a hose on it. I can use it as a water source. Just follow me here. Take some of the biochar you're creating, grind it down grind the heck out of it down between
shredder.
No, the shredder won't. You can get
don't get that fine.
Shredder, yeah. And then grind.
Well, it will if you get it too wet, but it's not worth it.
No, I'm not.
Comes out looks like black toothpaste, and it's hard. Don't do that.
No, that's a bad idea. No, but you guys can do this yourselves. But you just have to grind the living poo poo out of it.
It sounds like what we need is a trip to Goodwill and buy somebody's junk old blender, and that way you can add a little water, blend the hell out of it. When it blows up, you're out $10, go buy another one.
That's it.
That opens up a lot, because one of the things I've struggled with is how do you create enough of it to inoculate at a broader scale? And if we can start putting it into irrigation, then we've done that. We've done it economically. And there's tons of people out there that are already running drip irrigation, or I call mine soak irrigation, because I use PVC pipe with little holes drilled in them.
Mm-hmm.
Because my water's so hard that regular drippers get clogged.
Yeah.
But once you have that set up, then most people are familiar with how to do inline fertigation. Well, you're just using this instead. And now we're also, in the initial establishment, we're delivering it straight to the plants that need it.
Yep.
Versus trying to cover every square inch of the grow area, it that way. But they were just doing it with, just took it in the water and watered it, I guess, manually probably.
Yeah, that's it. That's all they did. But the thing about it is, the reason that we micronized it down to 4.83 micron, we called it 5M because 4.83 is a really dumb. I'd have to go like this. I'd have to sit like this. It's 4.83 micron. No. But anyways, the bottom line is this. We want to make sure it wasn't going to stick in fertigation tubes.
Yeah.
Through equipment. But you know what, folks? Just like you said, Jack, take a PVC pipe, lay it out there, drill some freaking holes in it, run your rougher micronized carbon through it, and do it yourself.
Yeah.
Now, exactly which size?
1/16 inch. 1/16 inch. Yeah. That's a drill bit. Now, let's go the other direction now, though, because we just talked about making it tiny. Stan says, what effect does less than perfect biochar or larger pieces of biochar have on the soil if applied? I think it's some people over worry about.
They over worry.
Yeah, I think you do. The one thing is that if you're not charging it, if you're just putting biochar out there, we've covered that already, but don't use a lot of it. Use very little.
That's a good point.
Because a very little amount of biochar will not cause deleterious effects, but it will add great benefits later on. Mm-hmm. And if sometimes your biochar is a little bit bigger, some of it smaller,
so what?
Don't fret about it. It's obviously in our world where we have to get data on what we're doing, and we have to prove it, and we have to get results.
Yeah.
We would say, it's a big deal for us, but not for everybody. Don't worry about it.
Well, I guarantee you in Amazon, when they were making Terra Preta 4,000 years ago, there wasn't a dude going, make sure it's all 4.73 microns.
Yeah. Right? One thing on this for Stan, though, is this. And you know, and you mentioned this in that great talk you had earlier. The quenching really is also a cleaning, filtering kind of a thing. And so that what you're removing a lot of that is the ash. And there's nothing wrong with ash, but ash does have a pH issue that might shock the plants or the biology, or, you know, kind of a thing. If it's if they're larger, it's not, you know, if it's less than perfect, just be sure that you clean that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. My next kiln I'm going to build is going to be a cheap $20 steel barrel, saddle cut in the top, bridge saddle, bunghole on the bottom. Adapter to a piece of pipe about a foot long, hose bib. When the burn's done, open the hose bib, pump the water in slowly from the bottom so that it slowly fills and steams as it fills. And I think you can build that for about $35.
Want to tell him that's your idea? With
With
the plastic. First, let me set it if you want to talk about it.
Okay.
This is a very cool thing. We're doing pretty good. Just this. Oh. Heartbreaking. So we're down in Haiti. We're down in Haiti, and they want to take us to this one beach. And we had to walk through, I think it was almost just short of 4 feet of floating plastic to get to the water. It was, and it was from the U.S., and it was also from, because it's an island off of Haiti.
It was mainland Haiti.
But it was mostly mainland Haiti. But, you know, you have that in, you hear about that in the Philippines. You hear about that in all these other beautiful places. Plastic is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Plastic is a biomass.
Yeah.
You can burn plastic. Now, my concern is what
comes off it.
The chemical aspect.
We're not going to use it for biochar.
No, but there's other aspects to making biochar. And so what I want you to do, Jack, is when you're doing your bunghole thing and all that other stuff with your building, because you said you had a metal shop, right?
I have a shop made out of metal. It's not a metal.
I don't do a metal.
I have a giant metal building, 18-inch metal building.
So the volatiles that come off when you're doing all this from the plant material or plastic can be collected and condensed.
Yeah.
Okay. And it makes some really great stuff. And Mark has, now it's still in its works, but
it's done.
Are you talking about wood vinegar?
Yeah. No, let me tell you what it is.
Yeah.
How you set it up.
I set it up.
So it took me about 2 years to figure out how I was going to do this. And then it took me another year to get it together. And then we started shipping down to Haiti, and then we got blocked. Because Haiti's in complete turmoil right now, so we weren't able to get it in 2022. But what it is, I took a 300-gallon used oil tank.
Okay.
I didn't have another use for it. And I went out and I scavenged three propane tanks, 30-gallon propane tanks. And this is the part that my friend the guy I do, he does a lot of work for me. He didn't like doing this, but I had him flip the propane tank upside down. So we took the top off, we flipped it around, and we put a ball valve on the bottom, and then we cut into it, and then we put connections on it. So our propane tanks are running in series away from the 300-gallon tank.
Okay.
And then we reinforce the 300-gallon tank with a 10-gauge steel on the bottom to make it last longer. So when we heat it, burned with it. And then on the top, we put a seal-tight top on it. So coming out the top, we went with two-inch tubing up to an elbow, back over to the first propane tank. I don't care if everybody knows this, because this is going to help everybody out. So it went from one propane tank to the next, and they kept increasing in height as they went away from the 300-gallon tank.
Distillation tank.
Now, at the end of that series, I ran back with copper tubing. It runs all the way back in, and it feeds back into the fire source. So we're burning the stuff we don't want to get out. We're using that as to keep the fire going and burn it hotter. And in the meantime, all the plastics are being broken down into their different forms of hydrocarbons. And the further they move away from the heat, and with the height of as we move away,
cooler.
They change.
Okay.
So we'll get something that's similar to a lamp will. And then
okay.
We'll get something else that's similar to a diesel fuel, and then something else that's similar to an unleaded fuel, right? So we're doing this to take the plastic waste and turn it into something that can use on the island.
I got you.
But this can be done also with biochar. So you can take an old 300-gallon tank like that, and you could soak the heat to it, and you can put a temperature gauge up if you want to, but please don't overthink it. It's not that hard.
Yeah.
And then go out to, run your same system out to a propane tank, but use wood, don't use plastic. And then what will happen is you'll start collecting things like wood vinegar, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it can be done on the cheap, and I had to build this for Haiti so that it could be recreated on Haiti. So
yeah.
I think about what could I put together that we could do again once we're there.
So you collect this plastic up and you get basically a fuel oil and a other petroleum, which makes sense because we make plastic out of petroleum. So all we're doing is breaking the plastic back
out
of petroleum.
Right.
Which would then incentivize people to clean it up because they'd get something out of it.
That allows them, the people, to collect it. They'll have a shredder. They could. Who knows if they measured the total amount that they bring to it? Just so cool to make that circular. There's that word again.
Yeah.
Circular economy, so to speak.
Back to the questions here. K-Bonk says construction drops good feedstock. I guess it depends on what it is. Like if it's not treated, painted, or had stuff spilled on it, if it's probably Southern Yellow Pine, 90% of it.
Yeah.
It probably is.
You know that.
That would be good. You're right. As long as it's not treated or painted, but yeah.
I've had people ask about pallets, same thing. If they're raw, naked wood pallet, then go nuts with it. Just one thing I'll tell people, if you're using any kind of suction grinding stuff and you're using stuff like pallets and stuff like that has nails in it, dusty carbon and spark equals boom.
Yep.
So please think about what you're putting into a kiln and what you're doing with it when it comes out the other side. Bob Wells with New England Biochar said they use, I always forget what it's called. It's the giant leaf vacuum thing that you drive around and tow it behind you. They call it like a bobcat or something. It's not called a bobcat. It's
a
water buffalo, whatever the hell it is. And he said the thing about that is, now they're not quenching. They're using retorts and letting it just fully, so it's super lightweight. It won't pick up nails.
It's the billy goat.
A billy goat. That's what it's called. If there are any nails that get left in any material, it'll leave them behind. And I thought that was kind of cool. And it's probably designed that way so that when a contractor's using it to pick leaves up off the side of the road, it's not picking up rocks and stuff like that. Yeah, you know. Green Country says, do you guys make wood vinegar also? I don't see it on your side.
Yeah, we do. And let me tell you why. I've known about wood vinegar since about 2013.
Okay.
And yeah, we do produce it through the pyrolysis plants. But here's the thing. The wood vinegar probably has a higher value, maybe a higher value than biochar does itself. What we can do with 7 milliliters, thank you, per gallon of water, and using it as a foliar fertilizer or supplement, foliar, or use it as a seed starter, seeds to germinate. I mean, it has so many uses, it's unbelievable. That's why I brought up that concept about how you can create your own wood vinegar too.
No cost.
But yes, we do produce it.
But you don't sell it.
No, we will be. The reason we hadn't is you got to understand that we went in 2015. We laid our demonstration plots to get data from California to Missouri to Michigan, Indiana, Texas, I think, Florida, Tennessee, and Haiti.
All
that in 2015.
Okay.
And so we've been so buried with the new launches of everything that wood vinegar, I've always known about it, but it's just like it's sitting back there. So
yeah.
it is an actually fantastic.
We're at a cusp right now. We have people working in the back of their website to add some things. We have some living soils that have the vital blend in it, a range from the different ranges. We have all this. We're burgeoning How often do you get to use that word?
I don't know.
But there's not a lot of us.
You have to do this, Lori.
There's the two. I mean, we have some wonderful support staff and everything, but it's just, it's that wane of the hungry or the thin chef, you know, kind of a thing.
Gotcha. This was really not a question, but I started when it came to, because I want to make sure we let people know about it in the audience. And I don't know if you guys have seen this, but Wild Unikitty says, "Hello there. I love the topic. We're planning to do biochar in our wood stove to heat your house in winter. I'm in Quebec. Thanks." If you read that and you don't know the trick, you might think he's talking about ash, but I've seen quite a few people doing this on YouTube, and it is really super cool. It works really well. It improves the efficiency of the stove, and it's dumb cheap. It's like $20 for each one of these that you buy, depending on how many you want to be able to rotate through. What people are doing is they're taking, they call them hotel trays. They're made out of stainless steel, and they come with a lid, and they fill them with wood chips. And once they get a good fire in their wood stove, they throw that lid on there. It doesn't clamp down or anything, just sits on there with gravity, and they put that in their wood stove. And it starts pyrolyzing the wood chips, and it off-gasses, and the lid lets just enough gas come off, and it burns inside the wood stove. And they increase the efficiency of their wood stove, and then you figure out for your stove about how long it takes to where you're ready to pull one tray out and pop another one in. And they're making biochar all winter long and reducing the amount of cordwood they have to put in their wood stoves.
Exactly.
And it's a $20 part you get from, like, you know, webstaurant.com or whatever.
Exactly. And by the way, you'd also be able to create wood vinegar. All you got to do is capture the water coming off of that.
Wow.
So just understand that.
Cool.
So it's not going to be the highest quality wood vinegar, but it will be wood vinegar.
That's interesting.
That's cool.
Hank, we just talked about one simple system. Hanging Laundry says, "What's your recommended system for the smallholder to make the biochar oneself?" I think it depends on what do you have. Like, I talked to one dude. He got in touch with Michael Whitman after we had him on, and he told this guy, get in touch with Kelpie Wilson with the Ring of Fire. This dude's pruning like 20 acres of blueberry every year. So he has a huge pile of stuff. You know, if you're a small holder like I am, what do you mean by small holder? Some people think 20 acres is a small holder. Some people think 200 is. For me, a little cone kiln, I have trouble making enough stock to fit in it to keep it going once a week, right? So I think whatever works for you. But God, once I saw people doing it with a $20, you can buy a $20 55-gallon drum off Craigslist anywhere in the country. That's hard to compete with on price.
Yeah.
What do y'all
think? I think the bottom line is how much you have available, what you have available is probably one of your first decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that most of the companies I've seen like y'all's that have tried to market a kiln, it's bulky, it's heavy, it's metal. And the shipping is stupid, right? And so it makes sense to, like, if you want to build something, I talked to like a local metal shop here and like show them, like, yeah, we can weld that together. And I think having them made locally is kind of the way to go with the kiln side of things. But yeah, 55-gallon drums are just, you know, put something on it, make it on an angle. And, you know, there's 100 ways to do it, I guess. You can dig a hole in the ground. I have not used kind of the more trapezoidal kilns yet, but they're easier to make than a cone. But whatever works for you, I don't know, man. Just pick one and do it, and then decide
what you want to do. You can go to the U.S. Biochar website, too, and search there, even. I know you have that link on your site from previous stuff.
Well, that's I'll have to make sure I add this episode to that page. I do have just for y'all that are tuning in, maybe haven't heard us talk about biochar on the podcast before, the survivalpodcast.com/biochar has all our past episodes, tons of resources, tons of plans for making your own kilns and things like that. What about using heavily sprayed feedstock? Do those herbicides and pesticides burn away, or is that an issue? We wouldn't really be doing that with the kind of feedstocks we were talking about. But what about that? What about biochar that's coming out of ag waste that's from these fields that are sprayed with all these herbicides? Are those driven off in the pyrolysis? I mean, I wouldn't use it for ag anyway.
Well, my contention, my theory on that is because we know that we can do this, we can One of our business partners is actually had a company called Waste Energy, where he was taking medical waste that was very toxic and able to pyrolyze it and destroy the damage or the toxicity of the stuff that was coming in, and then be able to take those products and dispose of them in a normal landfill. So I think what's going to happen with your pyrolysis, you're probably going to be destroying most of the, well, probably destroying all of it.
Well, most.
I would say most.
But a note on that. So hemp is a great bioaccumulator. It is a great remediator of soils. And they have been using, there's some trial stuff going on about using hemp to remove PFAS. And so there was a research I was reading on, and it was talking about the fact that if you then collected the using the hemp, this PFAS and FOS, that you could put it into, pyrolyze it and put it into biochar. But if it was too low, if the temperature was too high, it actually would release it into the air and it would be bad. You really kind of would just be redistributing it in a different form. Some types of herbicides and pesticides, their metabolites, whether it's broken down by combustion or whatever, also could not be any better.
Yeah, actually, some of the secondary metabolites of glyphosate are actually more dangerous than glyphosate is itself. So that, I think I would go with caution on that one.
You don't know
what secondary problems you're going to be causing.
Well, spray has become a generic term, and like as bad as glyphosate is, it has a half-life of about 6 months, and some of this other stuff has half-lives of human lifetimes.
Right.
So you don't know what that spray is unless you absolutely know what that spray is. And I
certainly don't stand downwind from it, no matter what.
I've asked Ecomouse here for a little clarification on what she's asking, because I'm not completely sure. She says, any suggestions on a biochar pit, 26 foot by 10 foot by 8 foot pit, 4 55-gallon water barrels on standby with a hose, composted 4 tons of manure there until this year. So I don't know if like there's compost manure laying in the bottom of this pit, but just, is there anything y'all can say about pit burning for making biochar on a scale like that? That's a pretty big pit. If somebody owns a backhoe.
Yeah, you can do a biochar burn on that. Folks have done that. Remember, you want to keep it low. This is another thing. You're going to get a lower temperature biochar produced out of it, but you're still going to get something, right? Mm-hmm. And if you have tons and tons of limbs and wood waste you're trying to get rid of, it's a pretty good way to do it. But remember that it's going to be a fire, right?
Yep.
So when you have fire with oxygen, what happens, and it's not a controlled hot fire, it's sort of like a big campfire.
Yeah.
You're going to end up with biochar at the bottom. You're going to have a ton of ash.
You're going to have a ton of ash. You can't really wash it away because it's in there with it.
Yeah.
My question, though, and she's here, so answer me. Tell me what's going on. She mentioned this, tonnage of horse compost in there. My advice would be to take that the heck out of there. I can't tell what she's saying, whether it's still in there or it just had been used for that, because I wouldn't want to burn on top of that. I'd want to reserve that, and then I'd want to inoculate it after the burn, but I'm not sure if that's what she's asking.
I think she may be saying she previously had composted 4 tons of manure there until this year. That's how I read it. But it needs some clarification, I guess.
Yeah, and we're not getting any, so... Ecomouse, we always handle your questions, but you got to tell us if we missed something there. Guys, this has been great. You want to tell people a little bit more about your website and some of the products you have as we wrap up here?
Yeah, honey.
The company's American Biochar Company. The website is ambiochar.com. We still have more products available. You're welcome to give us a call anytime you want. Email us as well. We're going to have it set up before the end of this year that you can order directly from the website. And we have both biochar by itself, and it's called Naked Char, and we have milled it down to the 4.83, 5 micron size, and we put it in water, and so then you can have that. We call that Naked Char 5M. Then we also take the Naked Char, and we blend it with humate, which has fulvic acid, humic acid, all sorts of really good stuff, and we mix that those two together for a liquid. Yeah, and we also sell the humate by itself, all OMRI listed. Everything OMRI listed.
Everything is OMRI listed.
Yeah, that's kind of important for us. Not so much for the OMRI listing, so much that we would be willing to test and make sure our products are a pass test that any organic farmer would want, whether you are or not an organic farmer. Then we also have our granular vital blend, and that is the granular naked char blended with granular humate. Raw, we try real very hard to always reduce, have as minimal inputs as possible ourselves. That one right there is great. It looks like rough coffee. Like I said, we're going to be making available online the Living Soils mixes that we have, and the seed mix as well coming out. That's going to be by the end of this year.
Which is one of them that we absolutely love is the Grateful Blend. We're not going to talk about this one, but that is a fantastic living soil.
Yeah.
I mean,
so right now, though, if people want to buy from you, they can get information on your site and they have to contact you to purchase.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They can email us through there.
We're getting there. We're getting there.
I got people. We have you guys set up with a shopping cart fast.
Yeah, I know. We're on it. Thank you. And by the way,
it's 2023 and all, you know. I mean,
I know. Hey, whatever.
Yeah, trust us. Everyone tells us this.
Yeah,
and we're there.
You wait till you see it. You'll be happy.
All
okay,
right.
And by the way, all, Jack, could I do one thing? Could I plug starfishmissions.org?
That's
the
thing.
That's okay, so that if anybody wants to visit and follow what's going on with the biochar products in Haiti on the Isle of Waginaw, it's starfysh.org. So starfish.org.
With a Y.
It's with a Y. And you pull it up and you can go and go to agriculture, click on the ag button, and you can pull a button. You can see what's happening with the biochar projects. Your prayers would be helpful there because it's a tough place right now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm trying to get it up. The site's just not loading right. It's.
It's just starfish.
It's
not it. Starfish with a Y. It's loading, but I'll bring it up on the screen here. It's the like there's an image that's refusing to load on the front end.
Okay.
But this is the site. So
thank you, Jack.
Let me copy that URL and people can check it out and go through all the pages on it. It's right there for you guys in the chat. And I'll make sure I add that to the show notes as well on the audio side. We will have the audio version of this show up about 1 hour from right now at thesurvivalpodcast.com. If you're watching the video, there's a link in the video notes just below the video. It will take you over to the audio version with all of the resources, including links to their site and to some of their social media and stuff like that. That's always the case. We always get people that are just in a hurry and click right now. Like, it doesn't work. It's not there yet. I got to eat lunch and then I got to put that up and then we'll have mm-hmm. that out. But guys, this has been a fun discussion. Is there anything else y'all want to let the audience know about before we wrap up here?
Don't get us started.
I would say this. So I'm gonna tell everybody something. My agronomy professor told me at Purdue when I was about 22 years old. And every day he would say the same thing. He would come in, and he's long since passed, but he'd come in and said, young ladies and young gentlemen, soil is what the world lives on. Dirt is what's underneath your fingernails. He said, nothing lives without soil. Dirt you can clean out of your fingernails, but soil, it's living. So, and I've never forgotten that, and that has been, that is so true. So, Keep making healthy soils, everybody.
Good job, Jack. Keep doing what you're doing, too.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate y'all being on again. We will have everything from these folks available to you in the audio notes in just about an hour. And with that, I want to go ahead and wrap up with everybody today. Remember, guys, you can always help support the show by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. That's where I publish my items of the day for you. This one I brought around many times. It's from my favorite electronics brand, Anker Soundcore. Live P2 wireless earbuds. I really do own them. Here's a pair of them right here. My son uses these. My daughter-in-law uses these. I think they're every bit as good as Apple AirPods that are $150, and these are about $50. But the reason I brought them around today as my item of the day is they're on sale today for $33 a pair. And some of you guys that are out there using the AirPods that are white, don't do that. You look like a scene from Something About Mary. These are black. They're much better looking in your ear when you're walking around listening to music. Anyway, you can always help support this show no matter what you buy if you just start your shopping at tspaz.com. Also consider becoming a member of the MSB. Several of our discounts alone will pay for your full membership. Remember, we just added Mile High Distilling this week. And I've been working on that for years. It took the owner selling out to one of his employees and having new ownership to get that done, because the old guy built great stills, but I just don't think he appreciated money very much. So he didn't understand this fixed revenue return that we get through our members program. But, you know, some of the still kits on that side are $1,000 or more. 10% discount covers a pretty good amount of your years of MSB if you pick up an MSB membership. That's how you make sure this show is here. There's about 70 participating vendors. I got another new one, a really cool small company I'm bringing on tomorrow for you guys. You can always learn about that by going to thesurvivalpodcast.com/members. If you want to support this show with value for value, remember, you can do that as well, right? Like, you can get out on any of the podcasting 2.0 apps like Fountain.fm or Breeze or any of the other ones out there. And you can either stream us sats or you can boost us. And I am on Noster. Whether you want to zap me or not, come on over to Noster. I've been really enjoying it. I feel like Twitter's turned it into a dumpster fire, and some of the best discussion out there and real intellectual thought is on Noster with a client of your choice. I will throw out a little plug for a Noster client called Domus, as in Noster Domus. I have been using Noster only on my desktop because I don't want to get addicted to the mobile device like a crack pipe. But I decided with all the talk from Jack Dorsey about Domus to give it a shot this morning. It is a very slick mobile client for Noster if you want to give it a shot. If you're not familiar with Noster, just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com or thebitcoinbreakout.com and search for Noster, N-O-S-T-R. And we did a show on it just a few weeks ago. And it's so easy, anybody can do it, even me. I hope you guys enjoyed today's show. As I keep saying about biochar, I think it is a component in this new parallel economy. We basically have a society that is burning its own infrastructure to the ground. It's burning its own culture to the ground. It's burning up its agricultural fields. It's lost the respect for the biological life that we were talking about today. It doesn't even, the people that lived at a time before they knew that there were microorganisms respected microorganisms more than we do, and we know they're there. We have two choices. We can wait till everything burns to the ground and we can rebuild it, or we can build our own while it's burning to the ground so that when they're done burning it down, there's a place for people to go. And I think that puts us in an interesting place in society. And these things that I've been bringing you, you know, a lot of this stuff, I think technology is not the word people would use, but they're all technologies. Biochar is a technology. Compost tea is a technology. Vermicomposting is a technology. Black soldier fly, and I call that waste elimination, not composting. That's a technology. Azolla is a technology. Duckweed is a technology. Fodder trees are a technology. We have the technology we need to provide everything that humans require and everything humans really want. It's up to you to take these building blocks and figure out which ones work for you. I have no belief at all in me that everybody that listens to this episode or other episodes on biochar is going to go out and make biochar. I wish you would, But not everybody can do everything. You know, you need one person or two people in your community making biochar for everybody. Y'all bring them your stuff. Somebody out there taking care of, you know, taking waste in to do vermicomposting, et cetera. We really need to work on building these parallel economies, because if we don't, well, just put it this way, no one's going to do it for us. With that, it's been Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. Are they going to bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.